Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, our friend, Dr. Jim Bryan, beloved physician and medical school faculty member, mentor to other doctors, recently named Tar Heel of the Week by the News and Observer, and one of the founders and a longtime advocate for hospice in North Carolina, has got a special project he'd like to talk to us about. And I have often thought of Jim as a model for retirement because it's I don't retire. I'm not going to retire. I might change. I might change my activities. Jim Bryan, welcome. We celebrate your career.
Thank you so much, DG. This is wonderful.
The one of your retirement interests, besides continuing to practice a little medicine, is in hospice. Tell us a little bit about hospice, about the challenge of coming to an accommodation, about dying, preparing for death, and preparing for life as death becomes...
Used to be an ugly word that wasn't uttered when I was coming through med school, basically, or in society. The Victorians suppressed it in terms of a conversation piece, although the reality of death was much more common back yonder, and medicine didn't have nearly as much to do to put it off a little bit. And the question about how to bring it in was sort of pushed by two people. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross brought it out in her book in the 60s on death and dying. And then Cicely Saunders founded the modern hospice movement. Now, the modern hospice movement, of course, evolved out of things that were championed by the church and other places to provide a place for folks to be as they ended their life. But she made it into a movement and brought it to this country, talking to the Yale Nursing School, and the Yale Nursing School started talking about it in the late 60s. And I was doing hematology oncology at that point, and I realized that as we expanded our capacity to address the medical issue of cancer, that we were often losing sight of the patient as a whole. And that was interesting because we started bringing death into the conversation.
Can you go back in time and remember the events or some of the patients that you were dealing with that you felt like you were not serving well just by applying everything you knew to keep them alive?
I would argue with my colleagues about the continued application of toxic drugs and keeping the folks alive to get more toxic drugs as they became available. Because when I started, there were very few agents. This was outlined beautifully in the TV series 2 weeks ago called The Emperor of All Maladies. And Ken Burns presented the story of the evolution of cancer care in that three-part series. And the last part, interestingly enough, he showed real patients and he showed real doctors working with this problem, this medical problem. And I was so taken by the young physician in oncologist in West Virginia who was talking to her patient who clearly was in distress and was on oxygen and was uncomfortable and not clear about what he wanted, whether he wanted to continue or not, and his wife who was in the room and the process that she exhibited and her emotions as she semi-applauded his decision to stop this terrible treatment situation and let him find peace. So the business about dealing with his suffering was the essential part of her work as she saw it at that point, even though she was applying the toxic agents.
Well, this took you back in time, and I want you to focus on the kinds of experiences that you had where one part of you said, I've got to do everything I can to keep this patient alive, including using all the medical devices, and the other part of you says, if I do that, I'm just contributing to unnecessary suffering.
It has to do with the physician denying the reality, because all of us, as we approach death, use denial as Kubler-Ross said, the first technique of dealing with this impending thing. Now, in our modern world, you know, we are encountering death in short-term situations, be it accidents or be it warfare or be it whatever it might be. But in a particular medical situation, it could be that you receive a diagnosis when you're feeling quite well, and then you have to deal with that as you go along. And the most important way to deal with it, of course, is with some physician who can take ownership of your problem and recognize that he's not dealing with you as a biological problem, but as a person with the mind and the spirit, and understand you and it within your family context. And that basically is what the birth was, because Cecily Saunders, back in the in the 40s and 50s, had evolved. She had been trained at Oxford in medicinal chemistry, but she took nursing training, and then she hurt her back, and then she became a social worker and became very close to a ex-Polish Jewish airman who was dying, and she met with him a great deal. And when he died, he said, "This legacy that I'm leaving you is to build the window in the place that you and I talked about, the place." Now, the place, obviously, the most place we want to be is home. And that is why the first hospice movements were, and our hospice movement here in the U.S. was based on home care, home nursing care. And that's what the Yale people had put in place by 74 when I visited Cecily Saunders' place and was blown away.
How does that home care, how did that work? What was the protocol for that? How did that work?
The protocol had to be that the doctor and the patient wanted it. And then when they wanted it, the team, which included not just nurses, but included folks that could help in the relief of suffering, be they chaplains or be they physical therapists or be they massage therapists or whoever, would come and relate to this person in their home. And this is the basic model with the family. And see, the family is suffering just as much or is suffering along with the patient when this process is taking place. And so they are actually trying to help the family. And indeed, part of Cecily Saunders' insight is that dealing with the family would help the suffering in the patient. And she dealt with the family in terms of bereavement care up to a year after the patient died. And that's what impressed me so much when I was able to visit the place that she had built in South London. And I came back and was able to demonstrate that.
You were talking first about home care.
Yes.
And then you came to see a place in London which
That's
was
correct.
Different from home care, but a place for
It evolved out of home care. Cecily set up a home care situation, but she, by that time, was an MD and had gone through palliative care treatment and had leaned on her friends to give money to build this beautiful place in this beautiful park, which was designed to deal with suffering of all kinds. Let me give you a little anecdote. The place had rules, and one of the rules was that Mondays are patients' days off. In other words, the families could not visit on Monday unless there was an emergency, and that took all the guilt about daily visiting and daily interaction off the family. I thought that was brilliant, and I really relished that. And in that place, the people who related to the patient, all of the team, be it the janitor or be it the LPN or be it the nurse or be it whoever, would take ownership and would and as they talked afterwards in their team meeting, would say, "I am really, this patient and I are really getting along. We understand fishing, or we understand whatever, grandchildren." That was the essence of it. The team would relate, not just the doctor, would relate to the patient in this process of dying.
Jim Bryan, let me just give you my take on this.
Yeah.
And then I want you to either correct me or adjust it. But it is that the hospice movement and acceptance of it comes from the idea that really when I have a severe medical problem and go to the hospital, the team of physicians and other care people are united in taking care of this particular problem and keeping me alive for as long as I could.
Solving this problem.
And all that's great as long as they, as long as it really is hope for me returning, getting well and returning to an active life or a better life. But at some point, keeping me alive in the context of it isn't going to last long is adding to the suffering or making for the suffering. And so the idea is that we at some point come to a decision that we really need to stop trying to torture this person, keeping them alive, but to provide for them a situation in which they may deal with the rest of their life in a with minimized suffering and in a way in which it's calm, quiet, and a time to spend time with family rather than
and concurrent with the hospice. That's exactly right, except one little bit. Concurrent with the hospice movement about providing a place for the very end game has been the palliative care movement, which recognizes that a lot of the folks interested in the biological problem may not be really up to speed in terms of taking care of the suffering in the hospital during the process of taking care of it. So the palliative care movement has arisen concurrent with the hospice movement, and now there's palliative care experts in every modern hospital that know how to apply pain relief and know how to deal with sedation and know how to deal with things that could make you to have a miserable time while your problem is getting addressed. And the problem is that you can keep people alive a lot longer with this modern intensive care that we have. We understand physiology a lot better, and we certainly have a lot more ways to deal with, say, cancer issues, as was exhibited in that TV program that I talked about.
Mm-hmm. We're visiting with Dr. Jim Bryan. He and I are talking about all kinds of things, end-of-life care, palliative care, hospice care. And in a little bit, we're going to talk about a special project that he has in mind. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Dr. Jim Bryan. We're talking about all kinds of things. I'm thinking about this in terms of background for Dr. Bryan, who has become an expert and a passionate advocate for appropriate end-of-care medicine and palliative medicine. And, Jim, I want to continue our conversation about this, but I don't want to leave behind a special interest and project that you've got in mind, and this is sort of a part of your retirement commitment. There is a challenge in providing hospice care in our region because of a shift in circumstances. Will you explain our challenge and how we're responding to it?
Well, the business about you can imagine being able to go back to a very nice home and a very nice wooded lot and being able to have transportation to your doctor if you need to go, and yet a lot of patients put in our area who are being taken care of by the hospice home care team that has been in place for many, many years are encountering the reality of the fact that, number one, they're older, their caretakers are older, their setting where they're living is sometimes marginal in terms of trying to think about trying to get a hospital bed into a trailer, for instance. And the public transportation in the rural parts is lacking. And the business about no matter how well the hospice team has organized volunteers and transporters and respite volunteers that understand and will give respite to the caretakers. The caretakers have a finite amount of energy, and the demographic realities are that that instead of having an old home place with the single aunt or others around, the children are in California or in Maryland. Mm-hmm. And there's a huge amount of family angst that goes along with all of this. And so many cases have needed to have a place to go to relieve some of these problems I just ticked off, so that they could be in a place where it was pretty and beautiful and clean, and the team was there to take care of them. And this has been evident even from the very first. At the very first of our work in hospice, it was an all-volunteer movement. And we indeed were able to keep it going with all volunteers, with money raised from cake sales and things like that. But Medicare recognized that the continued hospitalization of dying patients was a loss and an expensive thing. And so they started paying for hospice care in 1982, as well as insurance companies. And so since that time, there's been money available, and we've been able to have professional nurses and administrators deal with enlisting volunteers like I just listed, and have those folks address the particular problems of a particular patient.
What goes on in a hospice care unit like the one that we hope will
This is an extension of the same care that the home hospice people were trying to give, but we're finding difficulty because of the logistics or of the care situation they might be with the people. And this, what happens is they get transferred to a nice unit. We built one of these in Northern Orange with volunteer money many years ago, and it was taken over by Duke when we divided up Triangle Hospice. And now Duke has its own beautiful hospice way off in northern Durham County. And so the people that I have been taking care of in Chatham and Orange have a distance to travel, their families do. And indeed, the good work has been done in these inpatient units in a way that can mobilize more care at the end to deal with pain or symptom control, or to provide a setting where there would be peace, and that conversations about fulfilling your life at the end and meeting a goal of psychological healing could be accomplished. And so this is what happens. I have a thing that was sent in by a patient's sister. I don't know whether you want me to read it or not, but it's very moving in terms of the difference.
Yeah, please read it.
Okay. This is a donor to the current hospice building we're trying to build. Hospice became a part of my life when my sister was facing her death. She had end-stage breast cancer and was at home with my care and support of hospice nurses who came by to check on her. Hospice equipment and medications, what they brought to us at any time, day or night. She had not wanted round-the-clock professional nursing care because she didn't want strangers taking care of her. We did well for some time with this and the loving kindness of friends. As her disease progressed, her anxiety and pain increased and became more difficult to control. The hospice nurse came to see her one morning and told her that she could be made much more comfortable if she'd go to an inpatient hospice. After being reassured that she could come home if she became stable enough, she agreed. As soon as she entered her room at the hospice facility, she said, "Oh, look, a quilt." She loved quilts. From her bed, she looked out the window at the trees and lake, and smiling, she said, "I hear the birds." The nursing staff was able to get her pain under control very quickly and were attentive to any sign of discomfort. I could see her relax, and I knew she was free of pain and glad to be there. The anxious look on her face softened, and she fell into a sleep more peaceful than I'd seen her have for some time. She gave herself into their care with gratitude, and the waning days of her life were made inexpressibly easier for her and for the family.
Well,
So that is a good story, and this grateful sister has donated to this cause that I'm working on.
Well, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to talk about that cause that you've been working on. I'm visiting with Dr. Jim Bryant. We've been talking about end-of-life issues and a project that's very close to his heart. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Dr. Jim Bryant. I think most of the people in Chapel Hill know Dr. Bryant, but recently retired from his work on the UNC Medical School faculty, and but most of us know him as our physician. And Jim's concerns reach out to his older patients, and he is a Jim, I just have to say you're passionate in terms of your advocacy on behalf of the people that you've cared for a long time. You promised us that when we came back, you'd talk about your current project.
Right. And so as I retired, they suggested various causes that I could champion, and I knew that this was coming up because I've been having to transfer a lot of my hospice patients up to the facility in northern Durham. And I realized that the hospice nurses in Chatham were dealing with situations where there was no, where there was either no space for their patients or that the transportation for the families would be impossible. So in any case, we've envisioned for UNC hospice team a place which would fulfill a lot of the situation and logistics that we just alluded to. The Gland was given close to Pittsburgh, where the UNC hospice team works, and even though less than half of their currently active 80 patients. They see 80 patients.
Now, this would be
in their homes.
In home
visits.
Care.
And they are all varieties in terms of this journey that we've been discussing. And they have long recognized that many of these patients suffer at the end because of the things that we've alluded to. They couldn't do their full work on their suffering. And so this is going to be a unit which will take up to 10 to be enlarged folks.
Starting out with the 10 rooms? Or
10 rooms, and single rooms looking out on a beautiful wooded area with the creek and with the birds singing, I hope. And it's down near the cross of 15501 and 64.
Well, how much is this going to take?
Well, it's going to take a total of $5.5 million. I've never dealt with this kind of money. But in any case, people are giving very generously. And the land was donated to this project. So that took $1 million off of it. And the volunteers at the hospital, the various congregations in town, the retirement communities have already stepped up to the bat and have given a lot. And so many individuals have donated either in memory of or in recognition of the good work that this type of organization does. And so we're going to make it, and we plan to break ground or dedicate it in September and have the first patient admitted in 2016.
Well, that's an ambitious role. I know this is your passion, so I ask this question a little bit reluctantly, but what are you doing to spur gifts, and what do you tell people?
Well, I'm just getting the word out. I'm talking to the Kiwanis Club next week. I'm put the squeeze on some of my patients.
Give us your give us your sales pitch.
Pitch is, friends, a lot of folks, if we had our choices, would like to say, if I'm reaching the end of my road, I'd like to be at home, surrounded by my family, with good music and a good view of nature, and I'd like to have help with my distraught feelings about not being able to finish my race properly or whatever by folks who can counsel me and folks who can deal with my particular pains with massage or whatever else. And I want to be surrounded by the people who love me, and this is ideal. Now, obviously, folks like there's a special care of young people, and particularly babies and children, and my heart breaks when I hear about that. I was so thrilled to see that the Boy Scouts are going to ride across country to raise money for in memory of one of their classmates. And you know, death happens all the time, and if it's going to be recognized as inevitable and oncoming, then you know, we need to optimize the comfort and reduce the suffering of all that enter that process.
Moving, this is a sales pitch. We're going to move in. And so, how do you move to closure to say, hey, give me some money, put some money in this?
Well, many times, these are folks that I've helped cobble together care situations, usually in their home with or without the help of the hospice team. Because I was close to them and this little chapel community has so many resources that you can mobilize, but this is going to be applicable to folks who don't have resources.
So there'll be all kinds of potential givers who are believers in this or who are prospective users of the facility, but I hear that one of the strongest support elements for this are people with whom you have made this journey together.
Well, that's my work, but my professional fundraiser, who is just a wonderful lady named Priscilla Bratcher at the Medical Foundation, has instructed me that there are so many people who would like to participate in a good cause such as this that I don't necessarily know. And so I've been receiving seminars and fundraising from her. About raising money, and she understands what people can give and will give.
Well, before we leave, I'm not going to make you preach and ask for money all the way through.
Okay.
But some people who know you and admire you and or who have been persuaded for other reasons that this is a good idea and something they'd like to contribute. What's the way for them to make contact?
Well, UNC Medical Foundation at 880 Martin Luther King Boulevard, 27514, just with the UNC Hospice Building Fund, will do that. And also, there's a email that you can give, givingunc.edu. It's too long. I can't do this electronically.
Well, we'll put this up on our website, Jim Bryan. But I think that people who've heard your story are going to want to support.
I hope they do. I think that I personally have done it and will continue to do it. And I just wrote a check last week in memory of my friend who went on hospice the last days of his life, John Herrion. Who designated Hospice Building Fund as a potential way to honor him. And so this happens all the time in my age group. You're too young to understand it.
I'm not too young to understand it. And I tell you what, this is fundraising is over. We're going to take a break, and then I want you to come back and provide counsel for me and for other listeners about how we begin to approach what is one thing for certain.
Death.
One is death, and how we begin to approach this in a positive rather than a dreading situation.
Good.
So Jim Bryan and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Dr. Jim Bryan. If you joined us late, we're talking about the end of life. A lot of things that Jim's told us about, a wonderful project that he's involved in terms of a hospice center being built as a part of UNC Hospice down in Chatham County. Jim, I want to move away from the sort of development idea of how we're going to support you and support UNC Hospice in its effort and to talk just to provide a little bit of counsel. You're moving along in years, and I'm moving along in years, and yet it's hard for me to come and grapple with anything that has to do with end of life or death. I just resist the idea of, it's not that I intellectually believe I'm going to live forever, But I can't deal with the prospect of death as anything, as being something that's a positive event in my life. And you must have helped people like me or people who are a little bit closer to that time. Just listen to people. You have a hard time giving absolute directions.
Absolutely. Everybody's an individual in terms of where they come from, you know, and the metaphors that have to do with comfort and security, a mother's arms or whatever, are part of our background. And the meaning of family in our lives is individualized. It depends on the family and the resources that are available. As I said, the conversation about death was not part of the society up until Jessica Mitford's The American Way of Death's book, which preceded Kubler-Ross's book in the 60s. And the actual, in some societies, for instance, the word cancer is not, in some medical systems, in Japan, for instance, cancer is not used with the patient. It's used with the family. But yet Japan has a hospice arrangements in terms of providing gentle and supportive and symptom addressing care for their patients who have a chronic illness and therefore facing death. And the business about all of us will move into a sort of a taking inventory of our lives as we get closer to either the statistical times. You know, if you're over 80, there are no studies that indicate paying attention to cholesterol have any effect on anything.
So you had your egg this morning.
I had my eggs. But there is evidence that exercise is good for keeping you feeling good. But in any case,
it's not going to extend your life when you're moving towards in the 80s and 90s.
It has no effect on cancer, as far as I'm aware. So cancer is not the only reason, of course, we die. And the business about trying to die with grace, or trying to die with comfort, or trying to die without causing too much trouble. And one of the bigger problems in society is, of course, that this battle against death-dealing situations has led to the explosion in the science around dealing with those situations. And, you know, there are cancer protocols that can extend life for 6 months at the cost of $250,000. And those are the kind of societal and individual kind of decisions that you want to make. The business about whether or not the right to demand end of life. I was interested in that a Canadian Supreme Court has just declared that legislatures have to provide policies about doctors participating in ending life. And this was never part of my ethic at all.
Could you get there? Could you?
I don't think I can. Uh-huh. I don't think I can.
You could see how other doctors might.
Well,
I
can see where the situations, be it a chronic painful illness or the lady they had on the TV when they were having this explanation about the Canadians was miserable because of her multiple sclerosis. And the business about her decision, and she was very focused on she wanted help to die then.
Well, let's go through this exercise real quickly, because I can see where in certain circumstances I would be suffering from some inevitable death disease, but it's just going to strike out. And I would say to my friend and doctor, Jim Bryan, Jim, I've had a great life. I've loved every minute of it.
And I'm ready to go.
I am ready to go. I go without fear. My fear is that we're going to that modern medicine's going to extend it, or just the
Well, that's exactly why you wrote, and your lawyer made you write your prior directives in your will, and give power of attorney to your wife. Oh, I'm just assuming this, and the business about your shaping how you should be cared for, that I will not have feeding tubes, I will not have artificial respiration, and limiting what you want, the technologies, which technologies you want applied. The question about whether or not I would say to you, well, DG, you've had a wonderful life, and the question about I will take care of you and keep your symptoms at bay, I want you to know that if you in your current capacity and your will decide not to eat or drink, you would have less than a week. And I'm willing to keep your symptoms down and let you go through that process without having to have IV tubes. You will let me, in a calm way, not eat or drink,
move into death.
Natural death.
But you wouldn't give me a medicine that would help me do that.
No, I will give you the morphine to keep you from having respiratory distress. I'll give you anxiolytics if your body started getting anxious about it. See, we're all fight or flight is built into us, no matter what size of the animal kingdom we are. And this is going to be there independent of our age. And the physiologic mechanisms to keep us alive will express themselves in sometimes ways that make the family uncomfortable or make you uncomfortable.
Well, we'll shift it from me to you.
Yeah.
And you're in that situation.
Correct.
And there's nobody who's had a life you could be more, be happy in terms of your accomplishments and the kind of life that you've had, your children. You know, all of these things are positive. And so at some point, you will be able to say, I'm ready to go.
Yeah.
But if you've got a time of real incredible suffering ahead of you, notwithstanding what your physician can give to you in terms of pain relief, and you say to the doctor, this has been great, I'm ready to go, can you help me a little bit? You would not
say, I will help you with your symptoms, and you just stop eating and drinking.
That's what you've done many times. But that's what you'd want your doctor to do for you.
For me, correct.
And that you would just...
That assumes that I have the will to...
Yeah, we're assuming that you've got the mental...
But if I don't have the mental status and somebody else has to give me the food and liquid, and I've said I do not want to be sustained by artificial means, that means parental feeding or anything else, then that's in my will, and it's there.
And it's got to be,
we hope it's going to be.
Well, let me, in dealing with great people who have not only had to face death but have dealt with death, are there some really good examples for you and for me of people who've made death, a celebration of life? And could you just share that with us?
Well, the business about you, it's always a process. And I was taking care of a wonderful professor that taught me at the School of Public Health. And he says, Jim, I'm ready to go, but I want to hang in there till my sister comes in from South Africa. I said, okay, we'll do that. And she got there, and he left within 24 hours.
She got here.
Yeah.
And how did
you? He had a goal. And the business about, you can discuss support, and you can discuss palliation, and you can discuss whether or not he, after he saw his sister and said goodbye to her, whether he took the extra pain-relieving pills or not, that's not my business. And so there were some.
But you made them available to
him. Yes. Oh, yeah. He was controlling his own pain.
And so, let me push you just so you had some extra pain-relieving pills available to him.
Which would suppress respiration a little bit. But I know that he didn't take an excess number. He just took enough to say goodbye. And he was ready.
Well, I love that. This is where I would like to be. I don't think I can get there now, but that at the end of my life, curtain comes down, and it's the end of a play.
Right.
It's the end of a great play.
Yeah.
And instead of everybody crying, you want to applaud.
Celebrate.
Yeah,
that's
applaud
that's
and say this is great. It ended.
And how
can we get?
Well,
to that?
You cannot guarantee that. And of course, the aging involves things that are disabling, or strokes, or dementia, or things that are burdensome, and one of the goals in life for you and for me is not to be a burden, right? And part of not to be a burden is to arrange for folks who can help relieve the burden on your family, like hospice nurses and hospice facilities. And that's what that's one of the mechanisms that has happened in my medical life that has made me so excited about this whole effort.
Well, Jim Bryan, thank you for coming and visiting with us, giving us this idea of the project that you're supporting for UNC Hospice in Chatham County, and for giving us some good guidance about how we can do
that. Well, thank you, DG. I'm open. The phones are open at my house. I'm listed in the phone book, which, by the way, I can't get a new phone book, so I don't know who has my phone numbers anymore.
Phone books are another
another subject.
A whole new challenge. There are great things about the way we live, but doing without phone books is not a happy experience. Jim Bryan, thanks so much.
Thank you so much,
for your great example and for all your service to our community. Thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, Who's Talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.